Fishing like a local isn't just about catching fish. It's about connecting with the environment and the people who call it home. It's about hearing the stories and traditions that have been passed down for generations and sharing unforgettable moments with the people you meet along the way. Fishing like a local is having an experience that stays with you forever. And with Fishing Booker, you can experience it too, no matter where you are. Discover your next adventure on Fishing Booker.
This upcoming concert season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas is your stop for the best in Western style. Tecovas has seasonal and limited edition offerings this spring and summer, including men's and women's boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. All Tecovas boots are made by hand in a time-honored tradition with timeless styles that are always on trend. And Tecovas has first wear comfort with little to no break-in period. It's hard to find this level of comfort paired with this level of style. Stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, that's WCB style, and shop new styles. The smell of fresh leather and friendly staff are at your service. Many stores even have leather custom branding to make your boots truly personalized. And with regular live music and events, there's no in-store experience like it. If you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's T-E-C-O-V-A-S.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and ship right to your door. Go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
David Howe is an anthropologist slash archaeologist. He was introduced to me by a good friend, Corey Hawke, who's the organic archer on Instagram. And what David specializes in is ethnosinology. And that's his handle, essentially, on Instagram. And if you read his profile, it says, I study ancient humans and their dogs. And so I wanted to have a conversation with him, specifically in light of Colorado's ballot initiative that's coming, that is banning the hunting of mountain lions, bobcats, and lynx. Well, can't really hunt lynx, but specifically using dogs. They're going to ban it all, but they specifically reference dogs. And so I wanted to talk to someone who has the best knowledge when it comes to humans and dogs and our history with using them for hunting. David Howe is the man when it comes to this. So short, sharp conversation with David, asking really tough questions about where we come from and where do dogs come from, and whether or not hunting with dogs using a quote-unquote predator to go after a predator is something new, and or something that we should be frowning upon. Have a listen.
So there's a reason why I started Blood Origins. And that reason is simple. Is that I wanted to convey the truth about hunting.
It brings awareness to non-hunters that it's more than just killing animals.
How do I start it? Brittany.
My name.
Does my hair look okay?
It's fantastic.
My name is Mike Axelrod.
Start again.
Yeah, I hated it too.
Braxton, you said something in the car to me. You said that you were living on borrowed time. Hmm.
There's a perception around who hunters are, what we're supposed to be, and a feminist that works for a nonprofit that is a hunter that has only eaten wild game for the last 20 years. Is likely not the thing that people think about when it comes to a hunter.
So let me ask this question.
Yeah.
You have a dog of your own?
I do.
Hunting dog?
He is bred to do that. I just don't hunt with him. But
what kind of breed is it?
He's a Norwegian Elk Hound and German Shepherd mix.
Are you serious?
And a little bit of Malamute, too. But his mom hunted elk.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I have a Brittany Boykin Spaniel right now that is deathly intent to staring at the door.
Oh, yeah?
Because he's heard the UPS driver who tends to give him biscuits.
That's the hunting that my dog does. He waits for the postal people to come and chases them up and down the fence.
Well, David Howe, welcome to the Blood Origins podcast. It's been a long time coming.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for having me. It's Robert, right?
Oh, man.
The only person who calls me Robert is my mother when she's really mad at me.
Rob, Bob, Bobby?
Robbie.
Okay.
Cool. I've been a Robbie all my life. I was named after a Bob. I have never been a, I've never been a Robert, except for my mom, when obviously she's super mad, and Robert Kroger, you know?
Right.
So David, you have a very, very interesting background, and I didn't want to sort of get out in front and mess it up.
Sure.
So why don't you give us your background, and I think your background will then sort of shed light on why we have you on the podcast.
Yeah, man. I guess first and foremost, I'm an anthropologist, means I study human culture and behavior, but I specifically went to school for archaeology, which in the States, anthropology, or archaeology is part of anthropology, but archaeology isn't...
Where did you study, David?
I studied at the University of Tennessee, Knoxville, and then studied at the University of Wyoming.
Okay. Are you from Tennessee?
I'm from New York City originally, but I grew up in Tennessee. Kind of a dual life.
Are you in Tennessee right now?
I'm actually in Wyoming right now. Yeah.
Oh, cool.
I'm all over the place. But yeah, I spend the summers out here, and I'm about to head back out east Monday.
So, okay.
Yeah, but I studied, how do you explain this? Like, archaeology, a lot of people think it's grave robbing or, you know, studying pyramids or coins and stuff. But archaeology really is just studying human behavior through time. And you do that by excavating artifacts and whatnot. And not only artifacts, but bones and just what humans were eating. A lot of hunting. And I study specifically like hunter-gatherers, which is why I went to Wyoming. Wyoming has some of the best preserved archaeology in the country. It's just laying in the landscape. And one thing that I specialized in was stone tools and human use of tools and fire and whatnot. And then it dawned on me one day that dogs are a legitimate human technology, same as stone tools or agriculture. And that got me into a world of new things, which is where I am now. Yeah.
So you've obviously got a degree in anthropology, archaeology. What are you doing now, like as a day job, as a, like, what are you doing in Wyoming, for instance? Are you still on archaeological digs or?
Yes and no. I sometimes I'll work for a company. Sometimes I'll work for the university and do, like, I'm a contract archaeologist. Occasionally I do like big long field projects, but this year I've kind of just done freelance editing and writing and stuff like that for other archaeology companies, which I've kind of enjoyed more. And then for the big academic digs, like where we dug up the mammoth site or like the big bison kill, which, you know, that I just kind of, they invite me to come out on when I just go hang out and film and get to excavate. Mm-hmm. And I love that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about the fascination with dogs, you know, and maybe this is, you know, the whole point of this podcast is to truly understand the role that dogs have had in hunting. And I'll set it up like this, and you may not be aware of it or not. But currently in Colorado, there's going to be a ballot initiative put forward by, I think the proponent's acronym is CATS. Coloradans Against Trophy Hunting something.
Okay.
And so they're going to put a ballot initiative forward. It's going through the title board process right now. In February, they'll have to start gathering 125,000 signatures. And what that initiative is going to look to do is it's going to look to ban hunting of mountain lions, bobcats, and lynx. You can't hunt lynx anyway right now. They're federally protected. And specifically, it'll outlaw all hunting of mountain lions and bobcats. But specifically, they call out hounds, the use of hounds for hunting mountain lions and bobcats. And so when I came across you, I was like, man, I want to have this guy. I want to talk to this guy about, like, dogs and their use. And, you know,
right.
Because right now, and I'll say this, and maybe I'll start here. The use of dogs in hunting today is likely one of the most vilified practices there is.
Yes.
Because it's seen as unfair, David. Is it unfair?
This is something that I, like a lot of, I mean, we can call it political, we can call it scientific, like I swing both ways on and kind of ethically, well, how would you put this, like sway on? I would argue that dogs and hunting with dogs is one of the oldest, if not sports, but oldest, like sports isn't the word, you know, practices. It's something that humans have done.
Yeah, it's a practice. It's not a sport. I wouldn't say it. Well, yeah, it's tough. It's not, at the end of the day, if it may have morphed more recreational, but I agree, it's a practice.
Yeah, and it was a daily form of subsistence for people for upwards of 10,000 years. So it's something that, from many hunters I've spoken with and like hunted with, like you, I've never hunted with dogs, but I've been with people who have done that. It is like the most in tune and the most like in sync with your dog a human can be is when you're hunting, you know, animals with a dog. And I've never done that, and I'd love to try it. Because especially like my dog who's bred for it, I would love that. And like, I think the practice should be, you know, still allowed, especially when it's done ethically. And like when you have to cull a population of say cougars or mountain lions, the most efficient way to do that is to have another predator with you that can sniff them out and find them. And it just makes sense to me. But at the same time, I can completely see, especially having been born in New York City where you just don't hunt, like why you would see it as completely like a heinous thing to do. And having moved out to Tennessee and moving out west, being around guns and being around hunting completely changed my perspective on it. And, you know, especially hanging out with people who hunt and hunt with dogs and stuff, like they're not evil people. They're just like me and you. And they really enjoy the, I don't want to, like, again, not sport, but the aspect of what it entails and how hunting with a dog is just so unique and ancient, you know?
Well, I think it is tapping into that almost ancient relationship that you have, you know, you've studied so intensely. I think that's it. Like, there is no better way, no better feeling to see a dog that is with you, in tune with you, doing the thing that it was bred to do.
Right.
It's not like you're forcing the animal to do it. The animal wants to do it.
Uh-huh.
And watch it perform and watch it achieve what it's built for.
Right. And yeah, I imagine like when my dog gets I have the little flirt pole thing with him. When he catches that, he's amped and he parades it around the house. Like if you just fetch is just stimulating a hunting instinct. Search for my dog too, same thing. Like I feel like I am denying part of his like being not hunting with him. I just haven't had the opportunity nor have I trained him to do that. But at the same time, like my dog is bred to hunt elk and moose and he can track and I've taught him how to like sniff things around the house. It just seems like a disservice to have him trapped in a suburban house, you know, in a room all day waiting to like for me to let him outside and maybe go on a walk. But when we're out here in Wyoming and he can run around the woods, he is a different animal. And one thing I will say too is like when I'm out in the woods, I might see a deer and he doesn't see it yet, but there's sometimes where I won't see it and I can tell that he smells something in the wind and he'll perk his head up and look around. And that puts me on alert that, you know, cause especially out here in Wyoming, are there bears? Are there mountain lions? Like he's my alarm system for that. And I love that. Yeah.
David, can you express sort of theologically or maybe in an anthropological viewpoint why people think it's unfair to use dogs to chase wildlife?
I think a lot of people either think that it's not cheating. I would have thought, like, I guess a while ago that, you know, it takes, how would I phrase this? Like, I know it's a lot of work now. I'm saying this as a person who thought this before.
Yeah.
Who you know, the dogs just go find it and then you corner it and shoot it kind of thing. Or my other thought too was that the dogs just like rip it to shreds in a violent, you know, death. I know that is the case with some hunters, especially with bear hunters. Raccoon hunters, some people hunting a bear just come up, tree the bear, shoot it themselves. But that seems to be like a cheat code for people that seems not ethical. And then also, just personally, I think like when a cat is treed and it's hissing and it's screaming, and it's like doing that, you know, it's all reared up, it's scared. And I feel weird that the animal dies so frightened. But again, that's what animals do. Like dogs are meant to hunt, and like it's just how things are predated, I guess is the word, or how they're hunted. And if it doesn't die by a human shooting it, it's going to die, you know, of some illness and infection. Its legs are going to give out and it's going to starve. So like, I don't think a lot of people think of it that way.
David, do you think that I'm interested to hear your viewpoint here. You know, a mountain lion in a tree, some of them, you know, do hiss. They probably are going to hiss more when they're on the ground and their dog is baying it. In a tree, they seem pretty relaxed based on what I've seen.
Yeah.
When the mountain lion is hissing and snarling and swiping, bayed in a corner on the ground, do we truly think that it is scared, or is that just an anthropomorphic, like us putting on a human connotation of emotion onto that animal?
That's a good point. I do know my dog gets scared of gunshots and fireworks, and like he'll physically tremble and things like that. I haven't been around a mountain lion to see what its emotions are, but I do know there's one video of these hounds that trapped a mountain lion in a cave, and it was hissing. And yeah, you're right. I might have been putting my, like, anthropomorphizing its feeling at the moment, but obviously its heart rate's accelerated. It's feeling threatened. And if you're surrounded by five, what it thinks are wolves, it might be a little frightening, but... yeah, scared might not be the best word. But either way, it's natural. It's not like you're...
It's natural.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah.
So, David, I think what the most interesting thing that I want to hear from you is I want to hear about the history of dogs. The history of dogs in past society. And almost like that it's not something new that's being used today for the first time. It's an ancient practice.
Uh-huh. Dogs and humans, I mean, there's so much I could go on with, but I'll try to keep it brief. meet in Siberia, and then there's wolves all over Eurasia, but where dogs come into existence is Siberia, essentially.
And we think they're a direct lineage of wolves, right? Do we think it's a domestication of a wolf?
There are new studies out every week that will say it's a different species of wolf kind of thing, but a species is just a word we attribute to something, and at the end of the day, a dog is a domestic version of some kind of wolf, whether it's the modern gray wolf that exists today or something that went extinct. It's a wolf, and they can all interbreed. So that's the basic answer there. Yeah, so you humans get to Eurasia. They're probably watching wolves hunt to see how they hunt the new different fauna that's up there. And humans are monogamous for the most part. So are wolves, or at least they raise their young that way. Humans do. We have similar social systems. We, have language, body language. We alloparent, meaning that other people take care of children too. It's not just the human adults. The parents take care of the offspring. It's usually shared. Wolves do the same. So we all notice these kind of things. And when we get stuck in that glaciated environment in Siberia, there is a need for, essentially, to boil it down, like wolves have to adapt to life among invasive fire-wielding apes or not. And the wolves that exist today that are dogs are the ones that survived because they adapted to life among humans, either not agreeing, that wouldn't be the right word, it's anthropomorphizing again, but just figuring out that commensally hunting together nets you more calories than you lose. And that just seems to have stayed. And a wolf, a dog, in my definition, is a wolf adapted to life among Homo sapiens. So whether that is a dog scavenging trash at a dump in Mexico City, it's your dog you're hunting with. It's a dog that has, fully adapted to the presence of humans on the earth. Yeah.
So we think it started as a commensurate relationship. Like, hey, wolves are going to be next to humans. You're not really domesticating the wolves at that point. It's more like we work together sort of symbiotically to take prey down. You're going to, share some prey. We're going to take some prey.
Absolutely. And I would think that dogs scavenging human kills or human camps would be the most likely scenario. And they just kind of skulked around and found scraps or whatnot. Because again, you really need those calories when you're in high latitudes. But after a while, like if wolves started following humans on a hunt and, we killed something or the animal took off, that wolf's instinct's going to kick in, it's going to chase it. And then we probably realized after a while, like, okay, kill the ones that are going to bite you when you go up to the carcass. And the ones that are a little scared of you, run away from the deer or the antelope, whatever you're hunting, caribou. And you go up and start butchering it, you feed them a little bit, and they'll come back and they'll help you next time. And just multiply that by 30,000 years and you got a dog.
Yeah, so how long ago did we think this started?
Genetically, the closest date we have is about 20,000 years ago. Is that where we start seeing like what we would know as a dog species.
What does that look like? What does that look like, David? Like 20,000 years, we start seeing a dog species.
The dog samples that we find at that time and the genetic testing, like we start seeing, like, I guess if you were to put it on a graph, it would start to like, ding that like you have a dog. But that's compared to modern dog populations. But that's just, seeing what a dog in relation to a modern dog looks like. But in terms of a domestic wolf, it could be up to 30, 40, 50,000 years before, or not just 20,000 years ago, because again, evolution doesn't work overnight. So right. You would, like, those wolves were probably following humans around for a good 30, 40,000 years before we start systematically breeding them to look like dogs, if that makes sense. Yeah.
So the markers that you're seeing, the thing that's spiking, is it morphological changes, genetic changes, or both?
It's both. That's a great question, too, because a dog skull and a wolf skull are the same species, but they look different. A dog's face is a lot more scrunched in, the head case is smaller, and its teeth are more crowded, but it's still the same, like genetically the same species. It's a wolf. But those skeletons.
So let me ask this question. You're saying genetically a dog is the same as a wolf? No.
So, like anything in the genus Canis, which would be Canis lupus is a wolf, Canis lupus familiaris is a dog, it's a subspecies of the wolf. I should say subspecies, not species. But
so my domestic dog is Canis lupus familiaris.
Yes.
Which it's would not be, Canis familiaris.
There's different, everyone has their own way of classifying things. But again, I can't describe it other than species being a spectrum where it's like, how much more coyote is that coyote from that one?
Splitters or lumpers, right?
There you go. Okay, so you know the stuff. Yeah.
Oh, no, yeah. You don't know my background. I have a PhD in biology and resource and restoration ecology and whatnot, yeah.
I had no idea. So if you know lumpers and splitters, you know where I'm getting at then. but at the end of the day, awesome, by the way. Wolves, coyotes, dogs, dingoes. Dingoes are just domestic dogs that rewilded. And then some jackals can all interbreed. They're in the same genus and they can make viable offspring. So to me, that means they're the same species. But like a coyote is kind of just a natural dog. It's smaller than a wolf. It does its own thing. It still lives in packs in a sense. Like it's an interesting little creature. But I would say that, dogs are a like the same species, but I would branch them into a subspecies of wolf. But then people want to take different dog breeds and make them their own subspecies, but that gets too into the weeds. And
sure.
Yeah. Hope that answers your question.
So 20,000 years ago, we think morphologically and genetically, we start seeing, or maybe not genetically, morphologically, we start seeing changes between what was wolf that is now dog.
Yeah. So you start seeing about this time, and since you know this well, then evolution doesn't work like it does in, you know, Pokemon or in movies and things like that. Like, it doesn't happen overnight. So with that tooth crowding and that smaller brain case that you see in dog skeletons, that doesn't just appear overnight in the archaeological record. So you might find a dog that's in between that and a wolf, or you might find a hybrid, or you might just find a, you know, something that looks more like a German Shepherd than it does a smaller Dingo-like dog. So looking at the archaeological evidence, it's hard to say, because there's all sorts of variation in between dog and wolf that you could find. So genetically is why my colleague Angela Perry uses that as a kind of a solid marker for, we know by 20,000 years ago dogs exist, but there's definitely 33,000 year old dog remains in Siberia and some in Belgium as well that look pretty similar to dogs set about 30,000 years ago. So I have no doubt it's longer than that.
What does the archaeological record show? And maybe this is more in the cave paintings, hieroglyphics of the history of dogs and humans together. Because I guess you can, you're the more of an expert here than I am. How can we tell in the historical record this relationship between dog and human?
Yeah. That's funny you mentioned the art too, because weirdly, in all of that, like the famous cave art in Spain and France and Italy, there's bears, there's lions, there's hyenas, there's even what's the other one? There's another type of predator in there sometimes too. But there's no wolves in any of those paintings for some reason. So I also chalk that up to being there's also no humans. Because I would have thought, you know, painting humans might scare the prey away. Painting wolves might scare the prey away. But there's lions, there's bears, there's hyenas. So
there's no humans, like human hunters in those paintings?
Not in the big, like an elaborate famous ones. But those are like 30,000 years old, 29,000. 33,000 years old, Lascaux and Chauvet. But around 10,000 years ago, you start seeing dogs or canid-like things in paintings. So there's one in Spain, one in France, it's in Fontagamme, several in Italy. And then there's the rock art they found in Arabia about 10,000 years old that has dogs on leashes and like a hunter with a bow and arrow. And that is the first like unequivocal evidence of, and they're even canine dogs too. They have the little stripe down their side. Humans hunting.
What do you mean, canine dogs with a stripe down their sides?
Canine, as in like Canaanite. It's kind of like a dingo looking dog, but it has a big white stripe down its, like, from its neck down to its paw. And like, it's a distinctive looking dog. And the cave art, or the rock art, sorry, that shows them, like, 10,000 years old still shows that same stripe on them. Like, you can see it in the rock art. It's pretty cool.
Is there such a dog species like that today?
Yeah. It's, I think it's the national dog of Israel.
Really?
It's like from there. Yeah. And it's C-A-N-A-A-N dog, I think we spell it. But anyone wants to look that up. But they, that's the oldest cave painting of humans and dogs together, but there is a burial about 14,000 years old in Germany that is a dog and two people buried together. And some people argue that that is a wolf. It's not a dog yet genetically, but kind of gets into that.
Clearly
whole
was domesticated enough, maybe we would think, to be buried with its owners or with the warriors or whatnot.
exactly my take on it too. It's the first time that you use clearly intentional burial or interring these two animals together. And that is pretty significant to me, whether it's a wolf or a dog or not, you know?
Yeah.
So it is based on the archaeological record, this idea of humans and dogs working together is not new.
No, not by a long shot. It's very, very old. And I would even argue, too, that even, let's say, if dogs are only 20,000 years old genetically, we want to go 30, 40, 50,000 years ago, and let's say wolves are hunting or scavenging around human camps, they're going to scare away other predators and things, too. So, yep, they're kind of marking their territory around human territory. So, you know, or at least barking and scaring them off. So there's that relationship starting even without even, like, having to work together yet. And then once dogs are pretty established, about 20,000 years ago, clearly we're hunting, clearly. And you can see evidence of dog trading genetically across the old world and things. And yeah, so guarding for sure, hunting probably second, I would say, if not first. Yeah.
I wonder what your opinion is on this. I've got mine. I don't want to bias yours.
Yeah.
Why do you think there's such a, I need to choose my words carefully here. Why do you think there's such a strongly divided camp when it comes to wolves?
Yeah. My, I don't know what word to give this answer. My anthropological answer would be that wolves are the most similar animal to us besides, you know, apes and monkeys. So there's this, like, reverence for them. There's a fear of them. There is a healthy respect for them. And we look at them as, like, especially in, like, indigenous tradition, they're a noble animal. In European tradition, they're seen as, like, a villain. And then, but in most of the world, they're seen as a respected, revered animal. We share kinship with them, so therefore hunting them bad, and I think might be kind of where it comes from. And I remember as a kid, I was, what, probably 8? I remember when Bush was in office, but I saw on TV that they were drilling for oil in Alaska and it was displacing wolves, and I got all amped about it and wrote George Bush a letter, George W. Bush,
wow.
Telling him, yeah, I was like 8 or 9. My teacher, like, encouraged it and, like, you know, don't kill the wolves, something like that. And, like, I got a nice signed picture of George Bush from back from it with saying, like, thanks for writing. And, like, I just as a kid, like, I just knew, like, you know, don't hurt wolves kind of thing like that. And as an adult now, though, who has friends in Colorado and has been out here out west, and I know there's wolves out here, like, they do statistically don't hunt livestock as much as some people say they do, I believe is the leading thing. But they still do. And also, you know, I've seen videos of domestic dogs getting, like, torn up by wolves and things like that that live out there. But I would put that more on the owner for leaving their dog out there all night than the wolves doing it, because that's just what they do. But I guess what I'm getting at is I understand there is a healthy fear of these wolves might, you know, attack us. They might attack our livestock. They might mess with our animals. And I get why you would want to ban their reintroduction, but that would be on that end of that. But on the other end of that, it's just like wolves are majestic and almost went extinct, or were threatened or feared or whatever. I don't think they almost went extinct. That's probably too far to say, but you see what I'm getting at? Like, I can see where people are hesitant to not reintroduce them and to hunt them.
Yeah.
But I also completely see why you would want them not reintroduced.
Yeah, it's interesting. My even what you said earlier in the podcast about, like, where the domestic dog came from, our interaction with wolves in the Siberian landscape 30, 40, 50,000 years ago, from my perspective, I think the reason why we have such a divided interaction or relationship with wolves is, have you ever, and this may be a good book for you, have you ever read David Guaman's Monster of God?
No, never heard of it. Type it in right now.
Q-U-A-M-M-E-N, I believe is his name, Monster of God. It's a book about the alpha predators of this world. I use it all the time. Everyone listening to this podcast hears me say, talk about it. It's such an amazing book because it talks about Siberian tigers, saltwater crocodiles, the brown bears of the Carpathian Mountains in Romania. It talks about wolves. And the way that they couch it is that wolves and humans are alpha predators.
Uh-huh.
And so instinctually, there is a competitiveness between alpha predators. And so on one side of the divide, on one side of the relationship, there is this competitiveness that we have been in battle, essentially, as alpha predators for 50,000 years, 60,000 years. And so when you see a wolf, you see it as a competitor. You can add in different layers of agriculture and economies and all those kinds of things today that amplifies that.
Okay.
So that's the sort of we don't like wolves side of the equation. The people who love wolves side of the equation are the people who can see themselves in wolves. They can see the intelligence. They can see all this, the social structures that you mentioned that are very akin to a human structure. And then taking what you said, layer on top of this, of that, the buried genetically tribal relationship that we've had with wolves / domestic dogs for the last 50,000 years, creates this other side of the coin, which is we love.
Right.
And we don't want to harm them, and we don't want to interact with, we want the interaction. We don't want anyone to hunt them or kill them.
Yeah. No, that's a really good point. That's kind of reflected religiously and culturally too around the world. It's reverence, but there's also healthy fear. I didn't really think about the competition of them too, but I guess Little Red Riding Hood might be more in the competition end of it than fear, Fenrir in Norse mythology, he's a wolf that when the world ends will let his sons swallow the sun and the moon. So it's a pretty healthy respect and fear, I guess. But yeah, I'm gonna have to get that book. I'd never heard of that.
It's a brilliant book, dude. You'll absolutely devour it.
Okay.
Because it goes into things like, this is a little off topic, but saltwater crocodiles, talks about it in India and Sri Lanka. And then it talks about the Northern Territory of Australia. And in Australia, obviously you have hundreds of different Aboriginal tribes. And those Aboriginal tribes have different deities and different things that they worship. And some of them are tied in with specific wildlife. And so you have certain Aboriginal tribes that revere and have the deity of the saltwater crocodile. And then you have other tribes that they describe in the book that are like the manta ray is their deity. The people that have the deity of the manta ray get smacked and taken by saltwater crocodiles all the time in the Northern Territory, eaten. The saltwater crocodile tribes that revere and worship saltwater crocodiles never get eaten by saltwater. So you're like, wow, what's going on there? Is it like a true spiritual connection, they know? Or is it just because you understand them more, you understand their behaviors, you understand their habitats, and you avoid places that they possibly would be in? I don't know.
Right.
But it's very strange to see that correlation.
Your environment always shapes your culture in a way, yeah. So the ones that eat humans less obviously would probably revere them a little more or something.
Something like that.
Yeah, that is neat. I meant to ask, you're a wildlife biologist? I know your audience has probably heard this a bunch, but...
Yeah, so I got a PhD in biology, but wetland ecology is sort of my foundational base. I've loved wetlands and swamps since I was 16 years old.
Okay.
Studied university in South Africa, did an honors in South Africa, master's in South Africa, PhD here in the States, postdoc here in the States. I was a professor in the Wildlife Fisheries Department at Mississippi State University for 6 years. And then in that time, I almost, you know, morphed from being a wetland ecologist, keeping those fundamental principles, to being a restoration ecologist. So looking at landscapes, how can you modify landscapes, manage landscapes that are specifically tied in with humans? So wildlife management, hunting, agriculture, water quality improvement. And how do you create them? How do you manage them to benefit both humans and the environment?
Yeah. So are you a bird hunter primarily, or are you a...
You know, my wife says if there was a season for... This sounds really bad, but this is what my wife says, and she's a horror writer. So you have to, you know, she sure. writes horror. If there was a season for babies, Robbie would be hunting babies.
Fair.
So I like hunting everything. If there's something to hunt, I'll hunt it. I've never been on a dog hunt like you. I've never yeah. been with someone who has a pack of hounds and, you know, chases a bear or chases a mountain lion. I have been squirrel hunting.
Okay.
I've been squirrel hunting with feists. And it's fantastic hunting. It's fantastic seeing the dog work. It's, you know, to me, that's it. Like, you know, there's a vilification around dogs and being used to chase game. But they've done it for, based on what you just talked about, tens of thousands of years. They've been working with hunters for tens of thousands of years. It's not something new. And it's not something that you're essentially forcing on the animal itself.
Yeah. The videos I've seen of it too, like there's, they're chasing a mountain lion somewhere in the snow. And there's even like a puppy like trailing behind like the huge pack of dogs, and it's excited to be there doing what it's doing, mm-hmm. and it's like learning. Mm-hmm. And, it's not like something you force on the dog. I just found that interesting.
Yeah, and when you speak to houndsmen, we've got a big lion houndsman documentary right now in the film festival circuit called Lionheart. And to them, it's the cat in the tree and killing the cat in the tree is the last thing on the ladder. It's the dog. It's building the dog. It's building the pack. It's creating your own pack. It's the relationships with the individual dogs, watching them work. How do they work? How do they, what are they teaching you about the environment? What are they teaching you about the animal?
Mm-hmm.
Like they say, the title, a lion houndsman, is one that you just don't get. You earn it.
Never heard that. I like that.
Yeah, you earn it because you're putting everything every day, every waking moment into those dogs.
And that itself too is probably extremely ancient tradition too. Like my big thing recently is talk about this, like when agriculture comes around and we start focusing more on, you know, there's new jobs we'll have to do, like farming, someone has to make the tools, someone has to trade, someone has to build walls, someone has to, you know, build houses. You're not moving and hunting, gathering all day. Somebody probably specifically sat and trained, like there was a kennel master, or there was a, you know, someone who specifically bred hunting dogs or ran the dog kennel. And that is where you start to see like the variation in dog breeds starting to come out. It really booms in like the Victorian era, but back then there was still a big change from wolf to a dog. And yeah, I would imagine a primary driving force of that kennel master was to breed excellent hunting dogs. And then the hunters themselves, like you said, a houndsman.
Houndsman, yep.
Yeah. And like, obviously in Old Britain, that's quite a culture, you know, fox hunting and all that with dogs. And yeah, and then war dogs too. That's another thing. But I think we kind of try to fail.
What are war dogs?
Like a dog that just fights with people, and like a soldier that, you know, attacks another group, or a guard dog. Rome had war dogs. Greece had war dogs. Alexander the Great had several. The Spanish certainly had a bunch. They brought them here. It's a tradition for sure. Like a dog that's part of they usually just a general or a captain's like actual animals that protect him in the battlefield, but there are definitely dogs, especially when the Spanish guy here, he used them to check people down and do things like that.
Cool.
And Alexander the Great, for sure. The Molossian Hound, I believe, is what the dog is called. It's okay. A big mastiff-looking thing, but they were definitely war dogs. But the Spanish ones had armor, which was kind of cool.
Nice.
Yeah. I mean, used for not great reasons, but they had armor.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Well, David, man, I just wanted to... Well, number one, thank you for coming on. I really wanted to just... sort of just give a little bit of a history lesson, man. And yeah. I didn't know the basis of, you know, where dogs came from. You hear it all the time, you know, someone saying, you know, the meme where it's a wolf and a chihuahua and say, look at what humans have done.
Right. This was you.
This was you one day, you know, 10,000, 20,000 years ago.
Yeah. No, thanks for having me. I have a thing on my Instagram about this. Like, I did this in the stories a while back. I'll try to keep this brief. Talking about wolves or dogs and hunting and this, and it caused a huge rift in my following, and I lost like several hundred followers that day. I think close to 1,000.
Why? Because they didn't feel like that dogs should be hunting?
That would be the major source, but I think other people just followed me for the dog information and the memes. They didn't want to see an ethical debate about hunting cougars. And I got so much hate for it, but I was like, this is the definition of ethnocynology, is like the wolves or humans and dogs hunting together. So like, this is a fact, you cannot ignore it. And I got a lot more followers after that too, that were like, you know, my friend had sent me this and thank you for showing this perspective. Cause I see it both ways. And I think if you can't see it both ways, like there's...
That was our post, right? Yeah. I think I pushed it saying thank you for... I did something. I can't remember how we connected, but I think it was tied to that.
Was it? Okay. I'll have to look back. But yeah, I got several since then. I was on Meat Eater, then like, you know, all sorts of stuff. Like it is, or Bear Grease, not Meat Eater, but yeah, it's an important topic, and I think people don't want to talk about it or even think about it, but I think it's important to think about.
Well, and I didn't ask this question. Do you hunt yourself?
I have hunted before, yeah.
Okay.
Pronghorn.
But you're not like a diehard kind of like I'm hunting all the time kind of guy?
If I lived in one spot, because I don't right now, and like I just bought another gun the other day, like I would. I just don't. I live, travel in like a RV thing, so I just can't keep the meat in my freezer. But I would if I could. Yeah.
Is this studio that you're recording out of in your RV?
This is actually at my friend's house where it's a stop on my usual trips. Okay. We record stuff together. Yeah.
Well, David, I really appreciate you, man. And you're right. There is, as I said, and I say it all the time, there is no greater vilified practice in hunting that is chasing predators with hounds.
Really?
Chasing predators with a predator. So I appreciate you giving us the background history, man. And please feel free to tag us and stuff and interact with us, and we'll keep following you. And anytime you get into a debate around, you know, hunting and dogs, please pull us in, man.
Yeah, to probably
tackle some issues.
Sure. I'd love to get you on mine at some point to talk about this.
100%.
It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, we could talk about Lionheart. That's, I'll tell you what, man. We built a documentary. I've spent a lot of money on it, but we built it specifically for non-hunters.
Okay.
And it's a 40-minute long documentary and really takes you along this arc of a lion hunt from morning to finish, and explains what they're doing, why they're doing it, the reasons for hunting, the research tied to it. But then it's all based with, like, you know, all around the dog.
Yeah.
So
I'll definitely share that when it comes out. So let me know.
We'll do. Thank you, man. David.
Yeah, thank
good
you.
Good luck on your trips, man.
Thanks. Guess good luck to you hunting.
Well, that's it for today. Appreciate you listening. As always, leave a review, share it with your friends, and most importantly, do what's right to convey the truth around hunting.